From Glitch HQ on Riverside Avenue and chilling out, max and relax and all cool Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Martha McGarry and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are 90s consoles and video game soundtracks. And so, if everyone is ready,
let's start. Brought a lot of energy to that intro.
Yeah.
Well, I had to, you know, I had to be cool, right?
You don't have to be.
It's the 90s. No one was cool.
But everyone thought they were cool.
Right.
Even in their tracksuits and jumpers and stuff like that.
Yes. As was the style at the time.
Yep. So we were talking a lot about, because we're trying to come up with the adjectives at the beginning of the show, we were like looking up 90s slang.
We were, yeah.
It's a whole rabbit hole, and guys.
The main thing is the providence of some of these terms. Like some of them were 70s slang that came back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Some were clearly 80s slang that just the writers were too young to remember from the 90s. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, we took a weird, rigorous academic approach to it for some reason.
Right.
I looked up the etymology of radical and all that. Turns out it's made popular by the Ninja Turtles. Mm-hmm. And those came out technically in the 80s. Mm. So yes. I was right when I thought they were 80s. But most of their run was in up till 1996. So technically they're a 90s thing too. Yep. I'll admit defeat.
We can all agree that all that in a bag of chips is 90s. Is the 90s thing.
It's the 90s.
Even though I have no memory of this.
Yeah, like 90s stuff is coming back now.
Yeah.
It's like a big thing.
It's great.
And I was telling you guys before the show that when I was young, when I was in middle school, it was about 1998 or something. Mm-hmm. And I remember...
I was eight.
I won't mention my age. Yeah.
And I gave a speech in a social studies class where I argued that the 80s were coming back and nobody believed me. Mm. And I was insistent. I'm like, no, it's worked on these 20-year cycles. It was like this thesis I had.
Yeah.
And like even my teacher was like, that's cute.
Oh, hey.
Oh, yeah.
Hey.
But in the time sense, it's borne out. And so like I've been dreading the return of the 90s for a while now.
Oh. Back in the 90s, I was in a very famous TV show. Bojack Horseman? Anybody?
No, I don't watch
the 90s are back. Anyway.
Well.
Anyways. But yeah, but now all the young people, because they were only barely around in the 90s, the way I was barely around in the 80s, like the 90s has this nostalgic thing the way the 80s did for me. I liked when the 80s came back.
Yeah.
So I have to be like, even though I'm like grumpy about the 90s being back, I get it. Like I was there once.
Yeah. 90s are cool.
Yeah.
But people weren't cool in the... I don't know.
Yeah. There was a bunch of not cool stuff happening in the 90s, too.
This is true.
It was the end of history. Don't you remember?
No.
Oh, yeah, right. The Y2K and all that.
No.
Oh. Oh, man, Y2K. That was a fun time.
No, the end of history is this idea that after the Berlin Wall fell, there was nothing left for the world to fight about.
Oh.
Was the idea, right? Okay. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But it was this very first world idea of like once, because the Cold War was a big deal.
Yeah,
like,
right.
It was the threat of annihilation.
Yeah.
And so when that threat was gone and the smaller threats in the world remained, we didn't take them seriously enough or we didn't care enough about them in comparison. And there was this idea that like now, and that's there's a lot of positive futurism in the 90s because there was this optimism about like the world, like all the struggles are behind us. And it was very naive, of course, but it was an interesting time. It was called the end of history because the idea would be there'd be nothing left interesting to write about.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. That's cool.
Well, oh wait, we still have some more meta stuff.
Glitch,
but my transition there would have been, let's beam over.
Just everyone
our
knows
radical topic.
She had a great one.
Yeah.
And wants you to know.
Yes. Yeah. But GlitchCon.
Yes.
It's happening. It happened.
It has happened. It happened. By the time this episode is out.
Yeah, it really came quick.
Yeah, it did. It was the whole thing.
Yeah, so GlitchCon normally happens in the
Roadrunner.
Spring.
90s. Sorry. Keep going.
But this year, there was a whole bunch of different factors pushed it into the summer, into the fall.
Yep.
And then issues with the venue. And what ended up happening is GlitchCon, which has already happened, so it's old news to anyone who went. But for those of you who didn't go or didn't hear about it in time, the event kind of changed a little bit. It was free this year, which is really cool. It was held at the Twin Cities PBS affiliate, TPT, which is partnered with Glitch on a lot of cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And they hosted it, and it was on a Monday and Tuesday instead of over a weekend. And so it's very much different. It had a very short lead time because it kind of all came together at the last minute.
Yes.
And we haven't gone yet, but it's happened already for you listening to this. I assume it went great. hopefully, the partnership with TPT, I think, is a really interesting, angle on it. That's new this year.
My brother was interviewed by TPT.
Oh,
that happened before we're recording this podcast.
Yeah.
So yeah, y'all can, we'll link to that somewhere.
Anyway, I feel kind of bad because we didn't mention this on some previous episode. Yeah. We could have actually promoted it a little bit.
That's true.
But it came so quickly that we didn't have time to get it together. But the fact that it did come together quickly is a testament to like the fact that Glitch is pretty nimble and can put on an event when it needs to. When things aren't when all the planning can't be done the way that it was, say, last year, they can still throw on a great show.
Yeah.
So that's pretty exciting. So hopefully it went great. I assume it did.
Mm-hmm.
and hopefully it's a sign of like future cool things for next year too.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's beam on over to 90s topic, 90s consoles with Mark.
Thanks, Martha.
Energized. I don't know.
It's like we're on like a weird sort of pop culture newscast or something.
I don't know.
It feels like it.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about pop culture things.
Uh-huh. I hope this is nobody's first episode of this program.
We apologize for this.
We're normally much more put together than this. So my topic is 90s consoles, partly because, you know, we chatted at the beginning. Like, I grew up in the 90s, and I remember a lot of these failed hardware devices coming and going, you know, through the, you know, the Circuit Cities and the software boutiques of the world.
Circuit City.
and I want to talk about it a little bit because of where it's the place in history. And also, there's just a bunch of really cool stories. So I want to frame this by talking about like the weird hardware in various eras.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that interests me about this era particularly is that everything was very home consumer electronics. And that doesn't sound like it's a big deal, but compared to, say, the weird hardware of the 80s, which was very a personal computer, your Commodore 64s,
sure,
your BBC Micros, right? That we talked about, Martha brought up in a previous episode. The sort of enthusiast niche hardware was born out of the trends from the home computing, which was brand new and interesting and not altogether mainstream. And so a lot of them failed, right?
Yeah.
And so in the 90s, that it was a different story. It was born out of the trends of the home theater market. Because a lot of those companies started getting into computing and video games, whereas previously they were mostly just about making stereos and VCRs and stuff.
Sure. Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah. And in the and that's what I'll be talking about.
Yeah.
But it continues. So in the 2000s, the trend was more about hardware miniaturization.
Mm-hmm.
It was the era of the MP3 player, right? So a lot of the sort of niche weird hardware were little devices, right? Or smaller set-top boxes or add-on components and stuff like that. And then, of course, in the 2010s, everything was just Android. Because that's the trend in weird hardware, is that everything you now have a free open source operating system you can build your weird thing on, and so everything is based on Android now. It is interesting, like the different trends in technology impact not just the big successes, right, but all the little hangers on and also rans. I think that tells you a lot about the eras of how technology changes and grows.
Yeah,
and I think it's super fascinating. So. Let me get into the 90s of it all, this home consumer electronics stuff. And so the first thing I want to talk about is the Nintendo PlayStation. I think a lot of people know about this, but Sony was contracted by Nintendo. Originally, we'll put some links in the show notes because this is not the main part of what I'm going to be talking about, but I do want to touch on it briefly.
Yeah.
I was an employee at Sony who really was into video games, or rather was into the production of video game hardware, but Sony wasn't itself that interested in it. And Sony's this huge, huge company, still is, but then it was even bigger, behemoth in the industry.
Right.
And this employee helped design the sound chip on the Super Nintendo. And Sony, it was kind of a small project at Sony, no one was really paying attention to it. But then that employee wanted to do more, wanted to produce Sony's own hardware, like we had this, and got some approvals, but it was very tenuous, and a relationship with Nintendo. So the idea was going to be to make a CD-ROM add-on for the Super Nintendo. SNES CD.
Oh, okay.
They're going to call it.
Yeah.
And this is actually, there were already a couple of CD add-ons or CD systems by 1991.
Yes.
The PC Engine, or as we call it, the TurboGrafx 16, had a CD attachment.
Yeah. Sega CD, right?
Sega CD was, I think 91. Yeah, I have it here on my list. Yeah, I think it's 91.
Mm.
That had just come out. The Atari Jaguar wasn't out yet, but there was rumors of it, and because nothing at Atari stayed secret, I guess. And so the trend was that, right?
Yeah.
And before the next generation of consoles, the CD add-on was like a thing. And so Sony wanted to do that with Nintendo, and they went as far as they made a prototype. They started developing branding. So PlayStation was really going to be the Nintendo PlayStation, and it was a bit of a pun because you could play CDs on it, so you could play games or play music. It was, and that's where PlayStation comes from, right? Is this the notion of the add-on was actually a big part of the naming of the thing.
Oh, okay.
And there's even you can look online. There's like great photos of Super Nintendo controllers with Sony branding.
Oh, dang!
Because the other trend of this is when a third party company would make a video game hardware licensed. So I have a bunch of Sega examples I'll get into. Very frequently you'd have the company that built it would get their own branding on the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these weird examples of Sega controllers with a Panasonic logo on it and stuff like that. But this is one where you'd have the Nintendo with Sony on it. It made no sense at all. It doesn't make any sense to us in sitting here in 2018, but it wasn't that unusual. Anyways, the famously, the week they were going to announce this partnership, there was a bunch of backroom dealing, and it's a lot of the story is apocryphal, but basically Nintendo was like, never mind Sony, we're going to go with Philips and to make the RCD attachment.
Right.
And they announced it, I think it was at CES. Sony was spurned, and they had this prototype, which yeah. there is a recently a prototype the Sony or Nintendo PlayStation surfaced and actually a working device. I'll try to find that YouTube link because it's really interesting. Mostly it just played test stuff. It wasn't, and it really was the point of these add-ons was just to add more data to a game. It was,
you could do more stuff with
it. Yeah, but it wasn't meant to actually increase the power of the system.
Mm-hmm.
We think of the Sega CD as the more common one because it did increase the power, but that was actually a bit of an exception
to how
these things were normally supposed to go anyway. It was really just about getting those 650 megabytes. That's really what it was about.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. What's great about the Nintendo PlayStation is that it's spun off into two different, totally separate projects. One is, of course, the Sony PlayStation, right? Sony was like, well, we have all this technology. We've done all this work. Let's just keep going, right? Because Sony, also as an entertainment company, was already starting to make deals with game developers. If not for that fact, the PlayStation probably wouldn't have continued as a project.
Mm-hmm.
But because Sony had bought a music the music label, I think it was Columbia or one of the CBS Records or something, it became Sony. One of those, I forget. But Sony became more than a consumer electronics giant; they became a content provider in that era, right?
Yeah.
And so they had leveraged a lot of that, and they were going to make games for their Nintendo PlayStation. And I think one of the reasons that Nintendo backed out is because they had really terrible, a terrible deal with Sony about who was going to get royalties on software titles, which Nintendo really cared about, and they kind of gave the store away. Yeah, or was the other way around? I don't remember. It's very basically it was a bad deal.
Yeah,
and so when they walked away, it wasn't like the big tragedy that we think of it now. It just happened to lead to these other crazy events. So led, of course, to the PlayStation, but also Nintendo now was partnering with Philips, and Philips and Sony co-developed the CD format, right? So one the like Philips made a lot of sense as a partner. Like, it's the name you don't really know these days, but it made sense to partner with them. That never happened. People may remember not owning a Super Nintendo CD. But what ended up happening with that was that Philips went on to make its own console as well, but not using any. They didn't like get as far as Sony did with their prototypes. It wasn't really more than backroom meetings, I think, between them. But they were serious about making a multimedia device, so they made the Philips CDI.
Yes,
and as a result of the deals they made with Nintendo, they had the license to make games with Nintendo properties.
Right.
So if you know the CDI at all, you probably know it for its terrible Zelda titles, which were like sort of full motion video, cartoon, very, very bad games.
I'm so hungry, I could eat an Octorok.
Right.
That's what they say.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
It's really good.
You know,
there's a funny Polygon video that they released recently of Brian David Gilbert putting all of the Zelda properties, including those ones, into the same timeline, and it's great.
Wow. So they made three Zelda games.
They did.
Crazy. One Mario game.
Hotel Mario.
Hotel Mario, yeah.
Hotel Mario. It's-a me.
And, you know, it's so funny. I've done so much research on these things. I don't think I've even seen a clip of these terrible Zelda games. I've just read about how terrible they are. And I trust that's
true. They're bad.
Yeah.
They're bad.
And I have played the CDI when I was younger. I've had my hands on one, so I know how bad those games are. So I guess I don't need the nostalgia trip exactly.
Fair enough.
But that was a result of that. So it's difficult to say whether the CDI would have existed if not for the discussions with Nintendo, but I think it probably would have. But the licensing for those properties was a direct result of those conversations and those meetings and those initial deals, even though it resulted in, as far as I know, no engineering meetings or hardware or anything that came out of it. Okay. So that, this topic wouldn't be complete without a mention of that saga. Mm-hmm. But that's not the main thing I wanted to talk about. I want to talk about the three, and then there's a fourth, but the three main examples of these sort of consumer electronics set-top box style consumer, video game systems that were also meant to be part of your home theater system. Mm. And sort of that idea of a 90s system and how seriously everybody took this as what the future was going to be. So the first one is the Philips CDI, and it was the first home console to have any kind of internet features.
Oh, wow.
And what was interesting about it was that it was very cheaply made, but it was very efficiently made. It had almost no operating system. Everything ran off the discs. Mm. And I mean, that's not uncommon for an older system, but for a multimedia system of this style, they usually had a little bit more overhead in firmware and operating systems. Whereas the CDI was much more just about the CD format. That was its shtick. And Philips, being the creator of the CD format, they had the sort of the place in pop culture and in society to say, like, we are the stewards of the compact disc, and here is the interactive next version of it. And so that's what they pushed it on.
Uh-huh.
And then the software would then take care of itself, sort of, after that was the idea. Uh-huh. That's partly why it wasn't a huge success. But it was pioneering a lot of ways. It had a lot of edutainment and educational stuff, and a disc that would do email and a web browser. And this is 1991, so it's kind of crazy, right? Because those things were barely around in any capacity. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, the idea was at that time is the society was unsure how the world was going to access these things like the internet. Were people going to buy PCs because they were still very expensive? Mm-hmm. Were companies going to start making cheaper PCs, and that would be how people would be able to get them? What people didn't account for and what actually ended up happening was things just got cheaper. It wasn't that they needed to make cheaper, smaller, less capable devices. It's that components got cheaper every year. Mm-hmm. Or would they be more of these dedicated set-top box living room style devices? We just didn't know.
Yeah.
And so you look at a lot of these old things like web TV and like a bunch of these different things from the 90s, and you kind of think like, oh, that was so stupid. But people just didn't know how we were going to be using these technologies. And anyway, this is one of the first examples of an attempt to in the home theater style of it. That was pretty interesting. And so they really focused on this sort of education and entertainment style use cases, not as much on games. But because it was a pretty niche product, and because this is how it always goes, games were the things that sold the best on the system.
Right.
And so and that kind of caught them by surprise because they really believed in like the CD format to do everything, like to be this this force of good in the world. And so they didn't quite they didn't have the ability to understand what it would be good for now. And but games sold the best. And so they said, OK, fine, fine. So then they tried to pivot towards gaming and it just was too late. Even though they had done a lot to keep costs down, it was still pretty expensive compared to even PCs of the era. And so it failed. And this is going to be a theme for these types of devices. The CDI was not it wasn't a Philips product exactly. It was a Philips technology. They licensed the specs to other companies. So you would have Magnavox, LG, Sony even made one, Kyocera, all of the sort of like people who'd make a VCR made one of these things because that was the attitude, is that you developed a technology, you didn't develop a product.
Oh, is it like graphics cards sort of?
A little bit of how graphics cards are sold today.
Okay.
Where that is actually interesting because it's one of the only legacies of the 90s is that graphics cards have always been like that. Mm. But it used to be that so much more was like that as well.
Interesting.
And that's definitely true of the Philips CDI. That said, Philips is the company that made the most successful of the models. But my list is like 7 or 8, and that's even a partial list of companies actually produced models. Huh. And there were a bunch of different versions of it, too. They had little iterations. And the thing was only on sale for like 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
And it had like 8 or 9 different models. And then those were then all made by 8 or 9 different companies. Mm. Philips wasn't necessarily that interested in selling a product. They were more interested in making a technology. And that's true of the next one on this list, the 3DO.
Ah.
This is commonly seen as the Panasonic 3DO. But in fact, Panasonic didn't have anything to do with the creation of it. They just sold its most popular version. It was the 3DO company that was founded to make this spec. But very much like the CDI, it was a technology that was meant to be licensed to different companies to make their own versions of it. And Panasonic made the first and most popular because it really failed like immediately, this one.
Mm.
Panasonic, Sanyo, and Gold Star, which I think is like a sub-brand of LG. I'm not certain on that one exactly. They made models. So there's just 3 companies made models for this. But Samsung, Toshiba, even AT&T, because they were making hardware back then, they all had licenses to make these. It just failed too quickly and they never got around to it. There was a thing I read that AT&T actually did have prototypes that they demoed at like CES in the early 90s. This is 1993. And 2 really interesting things about this is, one, it was the most powerful console of its era. This was before the PlayStation and Sega Saturn.
Sure.
And it was it was designed for 3D games, so it was focused this processing power was focused on that, which was basically a first.
Yeah.
It was sold as a really powerful device. That was its marketing angle. It's like this is the next generation of powerful thing. But it did look like a VCR and it was designed to go into your home stereo system.
Yeah.
And it was meant to have different variations. Like you'd have you'd buy one from one company that was a higher end model or a lower end, you know, and it was just it was a bad idea basically. Mm. And that's why it failed. But its power was part of its big selling point. And so when the PlayStation came out and was just a little more powerful, everything it had been selling itself on was pointless at that. Yeah, like by their own standard, they kind of didn't see that coming. Like they didn't assume that the newest thing would come out.
Dang.
But like 93, 94, 95, like so many pieces of hardware came out in those years that it was sort of, I don't know, it's a self-inflicted wound. They didn't have anything else to leverage on.
Yeah.
The thing I love the most about this system is, and I had a cousin who like had all this stuff and had one of these.
Nice.
And is that it only had 1 controller port. And you're like, oh, well, that's terrible. But it actually supported up to 8 controllers. How did it do that?
Yeah.
It daisy-chained the controllers together. It
daisy-chained the
controller. Oh, my God. Together. So one controller plugged into another controller?
Yeah. So you'd have one person would be on the left side of the couch, and then the person next to them would plug into them and so on. And hey, you know, think about it. Like back then, you had to buy an expensive accessory to get more than 2 controller ports.
Oh.
And the controller ports increased the price of the hardware.
Sure.
So daisy-chaining them would increase the price of a controller. but it could keep costs down for the base consumer. So like there's some logic to it, right?
I mean, if you're thinking of it that way.
Well, it was 1993. You had to think about it that way.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
And the 3DO was very expensive.
Oh, sure.
And so there was like one of the things they tried to do to keep those costs down a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was very expensive and nobody bought one. So, except for my cousin. the thing of the 3DO did have a lot of, it then had some success in getting developers.
Okay.
So when you think of the CDI as an example, you're like, oh, that thing had, there was no good games for it, right? Mm-hmm. Of course not. Mm-hmm. But, the 3DO really did have, it had ports of, Wolfenstein and Doom because it was the only system that could run them. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of PC like, so it could get those. It had it's one of its most popular games was Myst. Myst was on there. Myst is a game you want to play in your living room. Right, it wasn't. People didn't because it was a PC game. But like it was on 3DO, it was kind of perfect for that. And it sold pretty well, at least all things considering. And it had really good arcade ports because it used a CD-ROM. It had the ability to store all of the sound data that would normally be on an arcade board.
Like
Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo, like its most faithful adaptation was the 3DO version, for example. So that's sort of interesting, but the thing collapsed within like a year and a half, something like that, because all these other things came out. So the last one I want to talk about, and it's a big inspiration for this topic, at least in this category, is the Pioneer Laser Active. Mm-hmm. This was a Laserdisc player. And so people who don't own a Laserdisc, Laserdiscs are, they're the size of 12-inch, vinyl records, but they're shiny like a CD. And they're analog. It's analog video. It's really weird. It's not digital the way a CD is. And it was pretty popular because it was more reliable and didn't have any, it wouldn't wear out like a VHS would, at least not until disc rot set in 20 years later. Uh-huh. But it was a sort of an enthusiast format. It was been around since the late 70s, but it didn't really take off exactly compared to VHS in the home video market. And then when CD came around, that was definitely higher quality because it was digital reproduction and the everything was better for audio, but you could buy music on Laserdisc, but it was not a common use for it. It was for video, right? Mm-hmm. Because you couldn't put video on CDs, really. Not exactly. There was a video, CD video format, but it wasn't great. The quality was very low. And so all of these CD systems were coming out, right? The 3DO, the TurboGrafx CD, the Sega CD. These were really popular.
Right.
And so Pioneer was saying, like, you know what? We just added the ability to put a digital sector on the Laserdisc to store audio. And then the video would still play on the analog section, but then that way the soundtrack to the movie could be played back digitally. That was an improvement to the Laserdisc format.
Yeah.
And I said, well, if we're going to do that, let's just make a LD-ROM format. So they made, basically, it's a giant Laserdisc with a digital section that you'd put software on. Mm-hmm. And then you'd still have all that section for analog video. So basically, it was better than a CD-ROM, even though it was a Laserdisc. because I think a lot of times when people think of Laserdisc, they think of how like sort of old-fashioned it is and how antiquated. But they're comparing it to DVDs. Yeah. Compared to CD, it's much better. So that's the long way of saying that Pioneer thought it would be a great idea to make a video game console based on Laserdisc using this LD-ROM format. And the way that a lot of those games worked is it was really great for rail shooters because you would play back this analog video and then you'd overlay sprites and other data on top of it.
That makes sense.
So a game like Dragon Lair, like those sort of Laserdisc games of the arcades, those were done very similarly, but back then all the digital portions were on ROM chips like a normal arcade game, and then the Laserdisc was just the analog video separately. Mm. This was a way to put it all together and make it feasible for a home console. So this is how LaserActive worked. Now, this is the best part about the Pioneer LaserActive, is it wasn't itself a video game system.
Okay.
It was just a thing that played discs.
Oh.
It had this expansion port that you plugged in. It was like the size of like a hardback book.
Okay.
Or maybe like a paperback, like a small book that you'd slot into the front of the system. And then that was the game console. And so they sold two different versions of it. One was called the Mega LD. Okay. And if you know your European terms for the Sega Genesis, you know that that is, in fact, a Sega Genesis module for this device. Mm. You plugged it in, it had two controller ports and a cartridge slot. So it was just a straight up Genesis that you plugged into the front of this thing.
Okay.
But when you plugged it in, it also could now read discs off the Laserdisc. So you had Sega Laserdisc. And so there were a couple of Sega CD ports that were put on Laserdisc for this purpose. But there were mostly, it was actually specific games that were in this unique to this format. And so it was sort of like a Sega CD, but it was Laserdisc. So very, very strange. And then there was a second module that was a TurboGrafx 16. And that also had a CD version, mm-hmm. just like the Sega CD did. So it actually kind of made some sort of sense, but also didn't. And so, and that, again, you plugged it in, had a cartridge slot, two controller ports, and then could then read off the Laserdisc, and it would do, they called it, I think those were, there's another funny name for it, because that's another console that had a different name in Europe and Japan than in America. And that wasn't as popular. The Genesis one was popular. So basically, they sold the Sega Genesis Laserdisc attachment, but the Laserdisc attachment was the main device.
Yeah.
And so it was just a, I mean, it was just a bad idea.
Like, it's confusing.
It's very confusing and incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
The cartridge alone was $600.
Goodness.
And it, like, you could just buy a Genesis.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
You know, like they, by at that point, I think they were under $200. And so it was very much someone with money to burn who wanted something cool and new and who believed in this like advanced format of like 60 minutes of video to go with their video games. Which, like, you know, Sega CD, you could have full motion video, but like very low quality and not a lot of it.
Right.
This, you know, could do a lot.
Yeah.
And things that some arcade systems could do, people were familiar with those types of games. And so it seemed very promising. But again, because it was this consumer electronics focused setup, it didn't have the same kind of like, they didn't have the same kind of instincts that a video game developer would have about things. They just thought, well, let's make the technology and then everything else will fall into place.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't understand like the how to gauge consumer interest, how to like get developer support. I think there were like 20 games total for this thing. But what's interesting about it is that it creates a unique problem for preservation. Because CD-ROM games, cartridge games, all that data can be dumped to somewhere and stored on the internet for preservation purposes or emulation or whatever. These can't as well because it combines a digital component
and
an analog component. And even the digital part, finding a player that can read and dump that data is kind of difficult.
Sure.
Right? And so there's a great Twitter thread where someone talks about all the cool stuff about the LaserActive and the difficulty in preserving it. And the two main things are, one is disc rot. These things, the LaserDiscs were not meant to last, or they didn't realize how long they would last, and they started to fall apart over the years. And the other part is the technological element of how hard it is to get the data.
Sure.
The other part is collectors don't want to devalue their collection by participating in a preservation.
Oh, goodness.
Isn't that crazy? You're like, that seems so terrible. We're like, I get it. If you put a lot of money into something and you don't want to like spend time to make it less valuable, right? I mean, the whole idea is ridiculous, but like, I understand the instinct.
Yeah, okay. Right? I understand the instinct.
But there's a great happy ending to this, and it's in this thread too, is LaserDisc, the LD-ROM format was also used by the BBC for a project called the Domesday Project.
Domesday.
And there's a thing called the Domesday Book, which is an old census book from the 18th century.
Okay.
It's sort of a famous historical tome of the Enlightenment era, you know, in Britain. And so the BBC had this project where they said, well, let's make a modern version of that. Where we had, you know, and so they decided to use the Laserdisc LD-ROM format for that. For this project of theirs, and it was just a bad call because they didn't that format was not long for the world, and so as those discs began to fall apart, there was a much more serious effort to preserve them, and there was actually a device called the Domesday Duplicator, which was designed to read this data, and so the people who want to save LaserActive games now could also leverage that technology to be able to read and dump that data as well.
That's awesome.
What's great about the Domesday project is it was also in partnership with Acorn Computers.
Yay!
Which, Martha, you'll remember from when you brought up the BBC Micro computer that Acorn also produced in the early 80s. Was it right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that relationship continued to make questionable technological decisions into the 90s. I think this stuff is just so interesting because of the bets people made mm-hmm. and the big bets and the things they did. And like these consumer electronics companies were like, video games are finally something that we can take seriously. And how do we get in on that?
Yeah.
I know. Let's just do it like it's anything else that we do.
Right.
Instead of doing it the way that these game companies had learned to do it. And so it's an interesting sort of like a cautionary tale, I suppose.
They may have thought that like we could do it better by just doing it the way that's been successful for us.
Oh yeah, and in fact, that's almost assuredly what they thought. Yeah. Like Philips and the 3DO company, like and all those partners, they were like, well, these gaming companies, they're making a lot of money, mm-hmm. but they don't know what we know.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. And so that was that attitude that lasted for quite a while. The last example of this is actually from 2000. It was developed in the late 90s. It kept getting pushed and pushed. It was finally released in 2000. It's called a Nuon. And it's basically similar to LaserActive, but for DVDs, where you had DVD-ROM, which didn't exist at the time, mm-hmm. And then also DVD video. And so you'd have a rail shooter style games. You'd have video with sprites and stuff on top of it. But it was also meant to improve the quality of the DVD experience. And so it was, again, a technology that was meant to be an add-on to existing DVD players, or you would get a DVD player with a Nuon chip that mean it could play games and also do extra interactive things. And there are actually a couple of DVDs that you could still buy today that are Nuon capable, mm-hmm. but wow. you can't do anything with them because no, there's no device that actually leverages it. One of them is Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. I would love to know what those extra features work because I have a copy of that on DVD. But that was really interesting. There's a great Ars Technica article about that effort. And I won't get into that, but we'll put that in the show notes because that's also a great thing of someone who just believed in something.
Believe.
And pushed it and it flopped because it was this sort of thing. People didn't want this type of attitude. They didn't want a partnered logo on a product they bought from anyone.
Yeah.
They wanted to buy something that they believed in on its own. Like this sort of licensing model is very interesting because it works in some cases, but it can't work in a lot of the ones they tried to do it here, where it's this sort of extra thing. People want one format for video, one format for music, one format for something, and that's when they'll get behind a licensing model. But when you start to have these different sort of like add-ons and extras that are not meant to completely replace, but are meant to supplant and be the premium option, people want to buy, they want to believe in a brand, they want to buy the Samsung phone, the Apple phone, they want to get the Nintendo product,
right.
they want that.
Yeah.
They don't want necessarily to buy the Philips version of some consortium-developed technology.
Yeah, thing, or an HD DVD.
Well, yeah, that's like the format wars. Like you can't have two things surviving, and the lesson of that is not only that like one has to win, mm-hmm. but also that like there's only so much room for things, even if they're not directly competitive to each other.
Yeah,
like the fact that the Nuon capable DVD players were not going to be every DVD player.
Yeah,
that's what killed it.
Yeah,
right. If they had wanted to push to make it every DVD player that. Not, I don't know what kind of chance they would have had, but that would have been the only way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because people aren't gonna. They're not going to bifurcate a market, you know?
Yeah.
Anyways.
There are 13 competing standards.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Da 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 da.
There it is. Transition.
Da 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 da. Da 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 da.
Is Steven representing 1-2?
Yeah, that makes sense. My topic is video game soundtracks. Because because when I was a kid,
don't let up on this, Martha.
Oh yeah, please, the whole time. I seriously, like, I would like
dun 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 dun.
I don't know this song.
You don't know this song? Even I know.
Oh, is it Final Fantasy something?
No.
We're just gonna.
Oh, it's Zelda! I heard it. I missed it. I didn't listen to Zelda soundtrack so much when I was a kid. Dun 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 dun
Please continue.
Okay. That was pretty great. So when I was a kid, I basically exclusively listened to video game soundtracks. And then I guess I grew out of that. But like, it was the thing for me and my brother. We would just like find soundtracks, questionably legally, and listen to those a lot. And I wanted to talk about that because like it was a, I don't know, I guess it was a big part of like when I was growing up, but I don't know if it was for y'all or what, how, like, what is your relationship with video game soundtracks? Did you listen to them at all when you were young?
When I was a kid?
Yeah.
Sometimes I would leave Zelda on the menu so I could listen to the menu music of Seasons and Ages on my Game Boy Color. But I don't think I ever bought them on CD. I'm trying to remember if I ever did. Now I often will listen to video game soundtracks, but not when I was a kid.
Oh, okay.
And now that records are coming back, we have a ton of video game soundtrack records that we play.
Yeah. The fun irony to that.
Like, yes.
Vinyl versions of,
Yeah.
It's really cool.
When I was young, video game music was, you know, I mean, 16-bit was about as complicated as it get. And then, you know, like I had a Nintendo 64 and my friends had PlayStation. And when things started to get a little bit more orchestral. But to me, I never really thought of video game soundtracks as anything to listen to outside of video game. Didn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. And even now, when I think of the video game music I like, I think about the way that it works in the context of the game. Mm-hmm. When people say like, oh, I love listening to that song, I'm like, I don't understand what you're talking about. It just doesn't, I don't think of it in those terms.
Yeah.
Even though that's definitely a lot of that music does exist that way. Like it doesn't, I think good video game music, like a good overworld theme is something that works in the overworld.
Yeah.
It's not meant to be listened to in headphones on the bus. Like that's my attitude. I think I'm wrong about that, but like, that's just the way I approach it. And so I don't seek it out because it wasn't as accessible to me when I was younger, when I could have like got the idea for it, I suppose.
Yeah. I always felt like it was really hard to, I mean, I think when I was listening to these, I was like 8 or something. So I wasn't going to try to go out and buy CDs. I guess I could have, but didn't. but I always thought that.
Also, I didn't have Napster until I went to college. So
fair enough.
Another thing I totally missed.
Me too. Napster just flew by me. I was like, oh, that's the thing. Oh, it's gone.
Yeah.
You had better.
Yeah. but I always felt like it was hard to get like CDs of soundtracks because I just thought that it was not a popular thing. But I think it was a lot bigger back then than I thought it was. It was just I wasn't aware of things that were happening. Mm-hmm. But I think that like in terms of like the video game soundtrack, I think that the way you're approaching it, Mark, isn't exactly wrong per se, because like I think a lot of it is in context. Like the overall music in Zelda that I apparently missed out on is like meant to be overworld music. But when I listen to that music, it reminds me of Legend of Zelda Overworld and reminds me of those feelings I had when I was going through the overworld and stuff. And so I think that like that's a lot of the appeal of soundtrack music to me, is that like it makes it brings back those feelings, or it makes me feel those feelings, because like the soundtrack, the music is supposed to make you feel the way that the game is trying to make you feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's how I approach it.
Yeah.
But anyways, when I was growing up, I would find the soundtracks on a bunch of different websites and things. Maybe we'll link to some of them. There's this one, it's like Kingdom Hearts Insider or something. It was a forum and they had a whole bunch of like links of rip soundtracks and stuff. It was great.
Wait, for Kingdom Hearts?
No, it was not for Kingdom Hearts.
Okay. Just because you don't like that series.
I do not like that series. But it was just called that. Let's see if I can find it.
That's how it started and then just got out of hand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like everything Kingdom Hearts.
KingdomHeartsInsider.com.
Mm-hmm.
There's a forum and it has a bunch of different rips and stuff of a bunch of different games. And it used to have like, they used to be like categorized and stuff, and you can like go through it alphabetically and stuff and find your music. And they used to update it regularly. They probably got taken down or something. Is it still active?
Well, there's just so many more avenues to get that music legitimately now than there used to be.
It's much easier. Oh, there's still update. Oh. I'm gonna link to this in the show notes. Maybe. But you know, buy your this stuff though. Don't Maybe I shouldn't like it. I don't know.
You should go look at it.
You should That's go look at it.
For historical reasons.
Yeah.
Yes.
For educational, academic purposes.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I feel like with relation to video game soundtracks, I think good soundtracks, they set the tone of the game very well. And I think that like when I think of a good soundtrack, that's what I think of is like it. If you listen to the whole thing, you like get an overarching feel of like how the game plays. Mm-hmm. I don't know how y'all feel about that, but like that's how I approach it. And that's how like I try to approach the soundtrack in Vengeance, for example, is that like I want this music to feel like the level that you're going through.
Yeah.
Charles went over that a little bit in the Code Comment episode we had on Vengeance.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. That's how I like to approach it.
You know, it's interesting you say it like you want the music to remind you of the game.
Yeah.
But isn't the music like a... If the music were different, wouldn't the game feel different? And isn't that...
Right.
Isn't that just...
So that's part of it.
So isn't it whatever music it is the correct thing for the game because it's a part of it?
If it's not Mac, I keep trying to think of a game where the soundtrack doesn't really work with the game very well. But when it's not matched up, it can be kind of weird. Like if the
well, I guess
the,
what I mean is that
it's like anything where they're like, if you're going for a certain feel with everything else, and then the music is just like,
yeah,
yeah. I guess
that was a face I made. You couldn't see it.
They could hear it, I'm sure.
Yes. In terms of like games that I feel like have discordant music, there's this game my dad has been playing for like months called Flame in the Flood.
Oh.
Yeah, have you played it?
No, but I went to a talk at GDC where they talked about how they made the river.
Oh, okay.
And the islands and stuff, and it was really interesting, but a lot of it went over my head because it was all a lot of math.
Ah, okay.
So, because it was procedurally generated.
Right, yes. So. It seems cool. Like it's a fun game. I mean, it must be because my dad has been playing it for months. But, like, the music is, like, kind of cheery and upbeat folk-sounding music.
Really?
Yeah.
That's weird.
I know, because, like, the game itself is really dark and stuff. And when your character is low on... It's like a roguelike. And when your character is low on health or low on resources and stuff, like, the character's face gets all, like, bloodied and sickly looking and stuff. And it just looks really dark. And, like, the wolves are all in black and stuff. And they look all evil. And it's... But then you, like... You're going down the river and stuff, and you're hearing this cheery music, and it just feels so strange.
Is it meant to invoke a, like kind of an irony?
I don't.
Maybe you don't get it because you're not playing the game.
That's fair because I'm not. Yeah, I guess like my dad doesn't feel like it's different, but
I'm giving it a lot of benefit of the doubt. But it seems like there would be reasons for that kind of juxtaposition.
Yeah,
it could just be that like they liked the music and didn't think about it that hard. I don't know.
I don't know. But yeah. I don't know. I'm curious if y'all felt like. If you had any soundtracks that really like encapsulated the feeling of the game that you were playing really well, I'm sure that like Nintendo things probably come to mind, but maybe even other examples too.
Well, I mean, not to be a cliche, but like, yeah, Nintendo things.
Yeah.
Mario Galaxy does a really good job. Like the main Mario Galaxy theme. As it you start out in this small place and it's kind of the music's kind of like, it's soft and it's orchestral and it feels big but quiet.
Yeah.
And then you get to the hub world and it becomes sort of majestic. And then it guides you and each piece is really good. And the thing about Mario games is that like every song is a theme song in a way.
Yeah.
Like more than most titles, I think.
Sure.
That's probably a pretty I'm sure that's probably true of other games, but that's the way it feels to me that like, when I think of like Zelda has all this great music, but I only know the main title theme. I love that song so much. And so I feel like I love Zelda music, but I'm not actually that familiar with it. But that main title theme is so powerful. And there's a reason you don't hear it in the game that much because it's not really good in the game. It's good as the theme song.
Right? Well, yeah. And also like if you hear it all the time, it's not as powerful.
Well, right. But I mean, it works really well as a piece of like, as a linear piece.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Less so than other types of music and games work.
Sure.
But Mario music, all Mario songs are theme songs, and they all work everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But Mario Galaxy does a great job of like letting you know the majesty of the world, and as it opens up into these big wide open spaces that are like that are empty, but like connected by nodes. Like it does a really good job of evoking that feel.
Yeah.
I think better than any other Mario game. Mm-hmm.
I really like the conservatory theme.
Yeah.
That it just like expands over time and it gets bigger as you like get to more of the area and yeah. stuff. That I really like that a lot. I did that in Super Mario Galaxy 2, but I didn't like that game as much and I didn't like the way they did it as much, I think.
Yeah, Mario Galaxy 2 is like better levels, but as a whole experience it's not as well designed.
Mm.
You know, the reviewers who gave it a better score are the ones who loved like the mechanics and the level design.
Yeah.
And the ones who gave it a worse score are ones who like the whole picture of Mario Galaxy, and Mario Galaxy 2 didn't do as much of that.
Yeah.
You know?
That's how I felt about it too. My go-to example for these is Donkey Kong Country Music, because mm-hmm. I love Donkey Kong Country Music. Especially the transition from Donkey Kong Country, the first one, to the second one. The first one, you know, it's got the jungle theme. And it's got, you know, a lot of it is just in the first game, a lot of it is like, not marimbas, that's not the right word. But it feels jungly mm-hmm. and like nature and stuff. There's like factory levels in the first one, ironically, but like, and that has music too, but like it's mainly jungle nature theme stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But like it's not exactly cheery, it's just like wild and
it's like polyrhythmic.
And it feels a little dangerous, but like, you know, you could still live in the world sort of thing. Whereas in Donkey Kong Country 2, I really love this because like then you're traveling to King K. Rool's island,
mm-hmm.
And you're fighting in the Kremlings on their home turf, and like everything is way darker. Like all of the worlds and stuff, like you have like abandoned amusement parks and stuff. And the amusement park music is like, it's bumping, but like, it's also still like really dark and stuff because there's just nothing going on. There's a bunch of skulls everywhere. The entire environment, there's lava. There's giant hives of bees with giant bees attacking stuff. But like, it feels way scarier. It feels way more dangerous and stuff than the first one did. And I really like the transition between those two games,
mm-hmm.
Because like, it really made me sort of understand why King K. Rool was trying to attack Donkey Kong, take the island, because like their island sucked. Their own island was bad. Yeah. Martha, did you have any soundtracks you really enjoyed?
Yeah, now that we're talking about this, I am just going through like all these games that I super like the yeah. soundtracks to. I think one of the first ones that I listened, like would look up on proto YouTube or whatever was mm-hmm. Like all the Myst music, like
oh, yeah.
the intro themes. Yeah, those are super good because they're like choral arrangements yeah, and yeah. stuff. Oh. So powerful. I really liked Alpha Centauri's music because it like the theme is really good at the beginning, but also the ambient music makes you feel like you're in space and also like you're alone, which was, or like it's dangerous.
Yeah,
I don't know, there's a lot of tension.
Mm-hmm.
Spy Fox, I think second or third one, actually had a whole soundtrack on the CD. And
oh,
so
really?
You could put it in the CD player and listen to like all these, they're just parodies of like James Bond songs.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
what was, we would listen to it all the time. Like Man with the Golden Bun, which is all about a baker who made golden buns.
Nice.
and Live and Let Fry, which is about frying fish.
Yeah. okay.
And
that reminds me of the GoldenEye soundtrack, because it's just all the GoldenEye, it's just the 007 theme, and all of the music is literally just the 007 theme, but slightly riffed off of it or something.
Yeah.
And my brother listened to that soundtrack all the time, and I always thought it just, they all sounded the same. And he has like a favorite one, and I'm like, they're all the same, Charles.
Yeah, it's like, it's all just like, it's Nintendo 64 imitation.
Yeah.
I guess there's a charm to that. I don't know.
I don't know. It's just the whole time. And I'm like, okay. All right. You can only feel so much like James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I've been listening a lot to a game I don't like at all.
Oh.
But the soundtrack is really cool. Far Cry 5 has a really cool, interesting soundtrack.
Really?
Yeah, and it's all very like banjo, plinky plinky, but I like it. I've also been listening to Destiny 2's soundtrack.
Okay.
That's really cool. Oh, and Destiny has a really interesting soundtrack story, because who was the one who made the original soundtrack that never got
the music of the spheres or something? Was it Paul McCartney?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, isn't there a Paul McCartney song or something in Destiny 2? One of my coworkers.
I think that then that music did get leaked because like whoever, you know, had a copy was like, I'm not going to keep this in the world.
Whoops, now it's on open. Like Internet Archive. How did that happen? I don't know.
And isn't there like some debate amongst Destiny fans as to like, I mean, you never know these things for certain, but like people are like, oh, they should have kept that music or whatever. Yeah. Not that they know exactly how it would play, because there's always changes and stuff, but
yeah.
I mean, how different from the actual music is it? Like,
I don't know, because I didn't really play the first game. Okay. I've only played the second one, so I can't comment on it very much.
I remember when it was like a single that came out, and it seemed weirdly unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's a whole story as to why it exists. But there's an interesting thing about games that have soundtracks, but then also a song.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So Portal is a really good example of that, where the soundtrack to Portal is incredible, but people remember it for the Jonathan Coulton song.
Right.
Still alive, yeah, which is great. But the soundtrack is really, really good as well.
Yeah,
Portal 2, the same story.
Portal 2 has good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it comes from maybe this is not. It's sort of damning it with faint praise a little bit, but it's the orchestration and the arrangement.
Yeah.
More so necessarily than the actual composition, like the style of the Portal 2 music is it the choice in how it was put together. Is really interesting and has a theme and a sense.
Right.
The actual melodies themselves are fine. Like I don't want to be cruel, but like I think what's most stand out to is that sense, that feeling that consists across the entire soundtrack. And and I mean that as a compliment.
Yeah.
But I can't really hum a bit of a sequence of it so much, but I don't mind that that's the fact, you know?
Yeah. Well, they don't all need to be Mario music where you can sing all of them whenever you want. Like some of them can just be background music. And like sometimes it can just be ambient noise. It doesn't even have
to be. It's ambient noise hour on the current.
Right. Yeah. So like I guess I'd agree because, like, yeah, I can't think of there's one song in particular from Pearl 2 that I really like. I can't remember the name of it. It's like the jump pad song or something.
I don't know how it, I know what you're talking about. It happens when you jump on the jump pad thing.
I'll link to it because it's fun. Yeah, that's another. That one's also banging.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like you can just have music that's like just background noise that you don't even have to pay attention to at all. Yeah. And that also can work for your game because that can be part of the game. Maybe you're playing a Sudoku game and you don't want to like, you don't want people sitting there headbanging to the music as they're trying to figure out their puzzles.
Well, so that gets back to my initial, my relationship with video game music is mostly that, right? That it serves a purpose in the game and that's where its purpose is served.
Right.
But people still, they'll listen to these full soundtracks. Mm-hmm. And so the question could it be in fact detrimental for some music to be like really, really good for just its own listening experience? Is there isn't to say that it's a sign of, but could it be that some music that's like that isn't quite as perfectly suited for its game as it is just great music to listen to?
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
I mean, like,
and there's probably a lot of music that's really perfect for its purpose that gets unheralded because you can't really play it on a Spotify playlist.
Right.
Yeah. I think like most of the tracks on for like the Borderlands soundtracks, they're all so good and make the world seem really cool. But like there's only one or two you can actually listen to. But they also do the thing where they put actual songs, like actual, like I threw that and through the Telltale version, Tales from the Borderlands, rest in peace, Telltale. like I found so many of the bands that I listen to now through the soundtracks.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I know that like there's a lot of soundtracks that people listen to and they don't play the game or they haven't even played the game. So like even when they don't have the context, the music is still, they still really like it. Yeah. I know like Lane does that a lot. He'll like listen to music that that he hasn't even played the game of.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it is kind of weird that like you can still, it could still be a plus because like people will be talking about your game at the very least, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it can also be detrimental in a lot of ways too, in that like if your music is like really good, it can also be distracting. And yeah, as
it Gwent can be, music.
The Gwent music?
Well, never mind.
Is it really good or really not good? Or
It's good, but then it gets really repetitive. So it's not really. That's
right, because you play that game for a while.
Yeah.
Oh.
And the music is like really high octane.
Yeah.
For what is essentially just a card game.
Okay.
Yes. But it's like good, like, you know, like if it wasn't you having to listen to it forever while you're, or, and Dylan has a bug in his game where the Gwent music happens outside of Gwent too while he's walking around. So I've heard that song a lot.
Well, that's hilarious. That's
funny. Mm-hmm. I remember my brother was talking about how he's designed the only song in Hyperdot right now. Come on, Charles, get it together. Because he keeps saying he wants to make more songs and he hasn't done it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, maybe it's because he's putting in like 8 billion levels that are all really cool. Jeez, Steven.
Hey. Thrown under the bus.
Well, you should just write a couple songs for him.
Ooh, man, I can't do that.
Believe, Steven.
I used to, like, when I was younger, I tried to make music. Using
Let's make a music.
Yes. Using Sony what was it? Is Acid something. Acid Groove. Sony Acid something.
I think it's just Sony.
Is it just Acid? Okay.
And at least I think that's what they call it now.
I hate that name because it makes it sound like I'm making acid in it. Anyway. Uh-huh. I tried doing that and it was really just me like taking a bunch of clips and stuff and like chopping them up and trying to put them in stuff.
Yeah.
And I did okay. Uh-huh. It wasn't that great. Seems like it'd be a lot of work. Something I could do.
Yeah. Well, the way I write music is all in MIDI these days. And it's, if you have any musical sense, and put yourself in front of a MIDI composer and you will have a good time and be able to express yourself.
Yeah.
Because the frustrating thing about tools, like when you're, especially when you're in like audio samples and like you don't have like a great recording environment, your creativity can be sapped because you can't express yourself enough. And so, but like a MIDI workstation is pretty good. I should put you in front of one.
I think I used a MIDI workstation a long time ago.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago. All of this stuff I experimented with, I was like, I'm done.
Yeah.
I guess I was the same way with making video games, but here I am today.
Yeah.
I could try it again. I would. Yeah, I would like to try it again. Maybe I could do that during the Global Game Jam. What I was going to say is that my brother, he's constantly thinking about how the music will listen, especially in HyperDot, because there's only the one song. So like it can't get repetitive or old. Because I mean, like, then you'll just stop playing because you'll just get on your nerves. And so he in fact talked about that in his interview, that like he made sure, he was really conscious of how repetitive the song would feel. And I think that like the song changes a bit in certain contexts. Like when you're in a level, it's more intense and stuff because like there's more things going on. But when you're outside a level, there's just, it's the same music, but like you took some of the stuff out to make it feel more like a menu thing, and it's less, it's more chill. So you can like relax in it. So that helps, like the little contexts and stuff really help a lot.
Yeah, I've written a lot of music for Metro Nexus.
Yeah.
And I really get a kick out of it because I have a song that goes for each art style in the game. And it's definitely a case of I just write something interesting and then pair it with art that I've done or the art that I've gotten from someone else. And then that creates the mood, right? So I'm not really designing one for the other. I just find a pairing that I like that works and makes sense. The problem I've been having is with my menu music, which I like, but I don't think is right for the menu music in my game. And I've been trying to replace it with something, but like I have not been able to figure it out.
You know, I agree with you in that like I like the music because it gets in your head.
Oh, it's like, so it really gets in your head. That's its problem, actually.
Oh,
I think it can drill into your head in a way that's distracting.
Sure.
I still like it, but that's a piece of music that has a specific purpose.
Yeah.
Whereas the music I'm doing for each of the levels, the character of it is determined by its own qualities.
Yeah.
Whereas the menu has qualities that I have to hew to. And so the demands are different. So like what you were saying, your brother was talking about, like there are certain demands of that are, you have to be more deliberate with. And I just haven't put the time in to like come up with like a balance that works for that.
Yeah.
It's really interesting about the way like music can change. They talk about this a lot in film. Like if you ever see a movie where a dramatic scene between two characters is happening and there's a lot of music, you know that it's a bad scene.
Yeah.
Because the music is tends to like paper over like an unconvincing performance or bad pacing or an unclear script as to what it's supposed to mean. Music will then fill in the gaps, and that's what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
But you can sometimes tell when you lean on that a little bit.
Yeah.
And so music is incredibly powerful because it can deliver so much. With video games, that's why I think it's like when you say like a music that matches with a tone, I tend to feel like any music can match any tone because the music creates it in a lot of ways. But when you have something very specific, like when you know it's like this section has to be this, then suddenly coming up with music for it is so much harder.
Oh, sure.
Right. It isn't just writing to that. It's it's that you start actually writing away from it on accident, you know, without intentions. And then you have to essentially do a little more iteration and play testing of your music in a way that you don't have to in other situations where you have more of an open-ended goal in mind.
Makes a lot of sense. It's probably why Charles had such a hard time with the Fingen soundtrack.
Yeah, give him a break.
Yeah, because we would tell him, make it feel exactly like this thing, and he spent forever trying to do it.
Yeah.
I think he did it, but like, you know, it just took him a long time.
Well, the other way you could do it is have a soundtrack and then make a game to it, which is, I don't know if I've ranted about Louis Zong on here on the podcast yet.
Have. Anyway, you have to ask, but I don't know about if you've done it on the show yet.
Okay. Louis Zong is awesome. He makes music and also is an animator for We Bare Bears. Really good. And he's got a CD that is a video game soundtrack, but there's no video game for it yet. And it's great. It's, I listen to it all the time. It's so good.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit of it. It's like, it does feel like it does come from something, but was written with nothing in mind.
Right? Yeah. Well, I mean, I think he wants to make a game with it.
Oh, okay.
I would just love to do a Louis Zong jam where you take, like, because all his music could be, it's all cool, ambient little, like, little ditties.
Yeah.
And, like, oh, man, it'd be so fun to do a jam where people just make a game based on his music.
Yeah.
That would be really cool.
I want more soundtracks with jazz music in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. SimCity 3000 has jazz music in it.
Yeah.
It's good.
Oh, yeah. I think Polygon just did a video on Sims soundtrack.
Yeah?
Yeah, and how the jazz piano, and they interviewed the person who composed it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I should look into that. Yeah, I love that soundtrack. It's great. You know, I really like jazz music, and I would just like to see it in more things.
Uh-huh.
Because it's cool.
Isn't the thing about jazz, though, that you have to give yourself over entirely to the jazz? Like, isn't doing something else kind of ruining the jazz?
That's,
I mean, Spice.
Could that maybe explain why you tend to see it more in games that are slower paced?
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's in Spy Fox's, speaking of Spy Fox's, more like overworld walking around soundtrack is all mm-hmm. jazz.
Yeah,
sure.
Isn't Grim Fandango kind of jazzy?
Yes, it is. I believe it has jazz soundtrack. I always wanted to make, I think I talked about it on the show before, but I always wanted to make a soundtrack or a game where, like, you make jazz music as you play it.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't figured out the best way to go about doing that yet.
Uh-huh.
But that'd be so cool.
Well, it's jazz, so any button input you do would just make some noise?
Yeah, well, yeah, right.
Wouldn't that just be jazz?
I mean, yeah, but, like, the player should, like, feel like they're making good music and not just random noise, because then you're making free jazz. And I'm not asking for free jazz and music.
You totally missed my burn on jazz.
I ignored that and assumed you're talking about free jazz.
Ah, right, of course.
Yeah. Well, I'll play us out. That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app. And be sure to give it a good review if you liked it or are nice like us. We really need to know you're out there, so leave a review and tell all your friends too. We also want to hear directly from you, so follow us on Twitter and all the other things at Nice Games Club, and email us at contact@nicegames.club. Lastly, you can find more about the show, your nice hosts, as well as get all the links and show notes from this and other episodes at nicegames.club.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Well, I'll play us out. That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app. And
play us out.
Sorry. This is after my own joke.
Yeah.
I needed external validation. Okay.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.